We're here on Family Day. Because as you said, Simon Douglas, this is the family we've chosen.
Yeah.
I don't know when that was determined, but I guess that happened. I would have voted against. I would have strongly voted against had they said that. They actually tell you in basically every TED Talk about work is don't make work your family because it's not your family. And I go, yeah. But then whenever it's this kind of time, it's always, you know, to the boss is your family. Then you're like, shouldn't I get paid more, family? I'm like, we're not that close a family.
Yeah, come on. We're like cousins.
Yes, yeah, second cousins. Just do us a solid. Help us move. Anyway, it's family day. I hope everybody's having a great day.
Love you too, man.
Yeah, I love you too. I love everybody here. Thanks for being here, guys. Thanks for being here, everybody. Walking through, as I always say, when we work on the holidays, the zombie apocalypse.
It's crazy.
Getting that little preview of what it would
really
be like.
Crazy.
Walking Dead style, when you wake up and you wander the streets and you look around and say, okay. It would actually, this has got to be when they film stuff like that.
Sure.
That would be the smartest thing.
Yeah.
Is just try to pack in as much as you possibly can on a
busy shooting day on a holiday Monday.
I was going to say a mid-February dreary day, freezing cold outside. Get everybody up, get everybody on set, and film. Use the streets. You got everything.
Yeah.
It's free, especially a city like this. Incredible stuff. Anyways, plenty to get to. Awesome UFC card this weekend that I'm going to break down in the back half of this hour. We had a record-breaking weekend in hockey, and also the Leafs just ripping off wins. And now people are just coming up with horrible, horrible, horrible theories, but we'll discuss some of those with Haley Salvian. I have Dan Bylsma today, which I'm really excited about. I was trying to book him for a while. There's just like a billion things to talk to him about. But he is someone who coached Tyler Bertuzzi for 3 years in Detroit. Bertuzzi obviously broke the curse this weekend. He actually was able to score a goal. It went off of his body. Matthews, the best goal scorer on the planet, had to shoot it off of, maybe Matthews' most impressive goal, really, considering, had to shoot it off of Bertuzzi in the net to score. But yeah, Bylsma, also the coach of the 2014 Sochi team, so about the return of Canadian, USA, best-on-best hockey, and what that rivalry could look like in 2026 when we finally get it back. 12 years, by the way, after the last time we would have had Olympics, which
crazy.
Is tough to swallow knowing
crazy.
That it's been a decade since we've had best-on-best hockey. And, yeah, it was NBA All-Star Weekend. So I'm going to start with this because I don't have a guest on this today. Maybe I'll do a little bit more if I end up having more thoughts tomorrow or on Wednesday. But here's the thing. If you didn't watch, that makes sense because you're an adult and it went late. But there were over 200 points scored by one of the teams in the NBA All-Star game last night. And this is before. Why is this a deal? Because Larry Bird, Indiana legend, right? Before the game started, basically made a call, a plea to the All-Stars.
He's like begging.
Yeah. Hey.
Please.
Play some competitive games.
Please.
And for a generation that says that they all mold their game after Kobe and they all fight to say who molded their game after Kobe the most, they refused to compete in this NBA All-Star weekend. Adam Silver, at the end of the game, was as upset, I think, as you can be publicly with what he saw from the game. A showcase game on a Sunday evening at 8 o'clock. And, yeah, he basically, in his congratulations to the city of Indiana and then the owner, he trails it off with, yeah, and East, way to go. You scored 200 points, and that was kind of it. And he gave them the nod. Everybody knew what was going on. After the game, LeBron James took to the podium. They asked him about it, and he even kind of expressed some displeasure, and he said, hey, it's something we've got to figure out, right? And he says, it's something we got to figure out. But he's also the guy that I would have thought would be at the head of figuring it out.
Sure.
And I do, I know everybody gets so hot takey with their stuff with LeBron, so you can't have a take like this and not have it sound as though I'm trying to be an attacker of LeBron James. I'm a fan of LeBron. I don't think that there's very many holes in the resume. But to me, this is kind of one of them is, hey, LeBron, you never did the dunk contest? And that partially changed the dunk contest. Had you ever done it, you could have set a standard.
Sure.
Hey, LeBron, had you tried to be more competitive in the All-Star games, you could have sort of set the tone. I think at this point of his career, though, it's too late.
Yeah, he's not going to, I mean, what, he's at 40, going to all of a sudden start slapping the floor and playing some D?
It's not his league anymore. And Giannis has moments where he's kind of trying. Karl Anthony Towns just shamelessly, Draymond buried him. That was the biggest winner from the entire All-Star weekend was Draymond Green, who was perfect with Charles Barkley. The two of them going back and forth was hilarious the entire time. It was actually spectacular television. Outside of that, the All-Star game was brutal. But where we land on this every single year is basically the same conversation. And I can't stand it because it's always three types. One type is just it's for kids. Shut up about it. Mm-hmm. You go, okay, great. Just get out of my way.
There's
honestly.
No point of even...
just go away. Just get out. Fine. If it's for kids, whatever. All of this is supposed to be technically for kids. Our adults... So... The All-Star game is where you draw the line where you go, this is for kids, but the other times you're watching men in pajamas
serious.
And shorts.
That's when it's serious.
That's when it's serious business for you. Okay, sure, fine, whatever. Just get out of here. It's all under the same umbrella of entertainment. I don't know why the All-Star game gets labeled as the it's only for kids thing. Last I checked, it wasn't kids buying league pass and packages and spending money on these tickets. And if it is for kids, wouldn't you want a showcase that's a little bit more entertaining? I've said this before. But if the parents are engaged in something, that's more likely to get the kid engaged. Mm. So if you go to an All-Star game, that's great. It's a cool event to be at. But if your parent is there going, wow, look at this. Yeah. Wow, look at that.
Did you just see that?
And guess what? How do you think I got involved in loving this sport? A big part of it was All-Star games. I was watching All-Star games with my dad and caring about the All-Star games. And then that developing into a couple of years where you would really give a crap about who was on the floor at the end of the game and hope that it was a close contest and that they were actually going to go at each other for a few minutes. This one, it was just over immediately. Yeah. Like, the East ran up the score. There was no defense. They went up by like 30 points, and then everybody just decided to see who could make the most ridiculous shot and who could play the most passive defense. It was a travesty. Like, it really was.
Yeah, it was tough.
It was a really, really tough game, even by its standards. Then you've got type two, which is the... Well, a defeatist is nothing you can do to change it. There's who cares? Okay, fine. And then there's three, which is, all right, how do you make this thing better? How do you actually, is there a way to do this better? Can you hold this to a higher standard? I think I fall in category three. I've just never been a too much of a defeatist type. Mm. That's why I do this, because I want to try to figure out a solution to things, even though a lot of times it is maybe pushing a big boulder up a hill. But I honestly don't know what the hell they do with the All-Star game because it feels like the players have completely checked out on it. They're not going to try. And I think that the league should be a little bit more worried about this than... And I think that they are. That's why Adam Silver's doing it.
Yeah.
It's because you have an awesome Sunday post-Super Bowl, post-football, where you get to try to grab the attention of everybody else. And it's pretty famously known now that... NBA ratings are down. Mm-hmm. That league interest, I think, is down kind of across the board. People will still root for their teams, but basketball had this cool thing of, well, it's supposed to be national. You know the storylines. You know the thing. But I think it's a league that a lot of people just follow through other media members. They follow it online. They're not watching the games
as much. Follow the social clips.
Because the games aren't as compelling as they once were. You can tune in, and it's like... There's 30-point blowouts every single night.
Yeah.
You don't know which games are supposed to be important because the standings mean less and less.
Well, I think that's a great point, too, because, like, it is a league where, like, unfortunately, the regular season matters way less.
Yep.
And, you know, now the All-Star game matters way less. And so I don't think the NBA wants to become a league where, like, you really are just treading water until the playoffs start.
That's it.
But that's it. That's terrible.
But that's kind of how it feels. The midseason tournament thing now, in hindsight, is it's fine that the NBA tried to get creative with it, and I appreciate them trying to do it. But given that the Lakers won and where the Lakers sit today and the feeling of it afterwards, even with the Pacers when they went into a lull, it's a little... It's going to be interesting to see how it operates next year. Let's just say. Like, it'll be interesting to see how it's received because they kind of had a bit of a perfect storm and still now it feels mocked.
I'm going to be honest, until you brought it up, I totally forgot that it even happened. Well,
but this is the thing. I know it's pretty easy just to simply go and blame the players, but this is one where I sort of do blame the players.
I agree. And I think, like you said, too, and like I think a lot of people thought this, the whole Kobe thing, like you need that weirdo who's going to lift the level. And there's no one out there who's doing that.
But
you know?
this is what I mean about LeBron. It's this kind of part of his legacy is that he was passive with the All-Star game. Mm. He always said when the load management thing was going on that he wasn't going to be a load management guy and he wouldn't do that. And LeBron's sort of been the dude who's just, hey, everybody do your own thing. Because LeBron carved out his own path. He started jumping around and going team to team. And so he couldn't be the one that would criticize a guy like Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm. He did change the NBA. I think a lot for the better when it came to player empowerment. But this is sort of where you see it get to a point where there's a disconnect between some of these guys and the fans. And when you're getting paid as much as enough where you can buy a franchise someday, which is most of these guys on the floor, right? Can't imagine it's easy to get up for an All-Star game.
Sure.
Can't imagine that they care. And it was sad for me to see guys like, you always know there's going to be some dudes that just do not care about the All-Star game, and that's fine. There's going to be some guys that just, they can't engage in it, they can't do whatever. But basketball is not this crazy physical sport. Hockey is harder at the All-Star game because you go, okay, you can't have hitting.
Football's
impossible. You can't have hitting. But basketball, these guys play pickup games in the summer that is far more competitive than the All-Star game. And they play against each other.
Yeah.
They'll go down to the Drew League and they'll lace
things
up.
Things will get heated and things
exactly.
will get like, yeah.
And so I don't understand why there can't be some measure of, hey, as a league, we need to try to take this a little bit more seriously because a lot of casuals watch this. We are trying to grow our game. Ratings are down. Everybody says that we're soft. Everybody says that we don't care. And then, boom, you end up having this where it's 200 points and it's Carl Anthony Towns just sitting underneath the basket waiting for outlet passes so that he can dunk it and try to... I don't even know. I turned it off before they even named All-Star MVP. Who was it?
Dame.
Yeah. Who cares? Yeah.
Who cares?
You know why? Because he's one of the dudes who will try a little bit. Mm-hmm. He will stat chase and he'll pull up from three from deep over and over and over again and he'll hit them. That's basically who wins All-Star MVP next year is who can stay the hottest from behind, like 4 feet behind the three-point line, the longest. And so Damian Lillard has a big advantage because he's one of the better guys at doing that. So congrats, NBA. It was an awful weekend. The dunk contest was horrific.
Yeah.
Like, my God, those judges. I'm sorry. It was weird because those guys, they bring in basically two G League guys now a year.
Yeah.
I bet on Jacob Toppin because I'd never heard of him before, and I went, well, obviously
he
has
got robbed.
He did get robbed. I was actually kind of pissed off about it because I thought that was a good bet. And after he did that second dunk, I was texting everybody going, I told you, and then the judges robbed him. And they gave it to Jaylen Brown because the props. And I thought, you know, maybe we are at the point where it's either a year off or we just say, hey, no more putting on jerseys of former greats and doing the former great thing because it sways the judges too heavily. You got Dominique Wilkins on the panel.
Why was that guy dressed up as Dominique Wilkins?
I still don't know.
Does anyone understand why that guy was dressed up?
The worst part is that I was rooting for Jaylen Brown heavily because
he was an
actual All-Star 100%. That went to the dunk contest.
100%.
And then he mailed it in the most. And I went, I'm so conflicted here. Also, the three-point contest is completely dead. It's just done. With Steph Curry not in it, it just doesn't matter anymore. And like, it was good that he did the shoot-around thing with Sabrina.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was fine. Who cares, honestly? It was when she started raining buckets, that was actually the moment of All-Star Weekend.
100%.
Was the first rack. I went, oh, crap, this is really cool.
Yeah.
And then, the rest of it was kind of crap.
I got a thought to pitch at you for Saturday. We'll save it for later.
Uh-huh.
But, later in the show, I got a thought about Saturday night and how to add some juice that I'll pitch at you a little bit.
All right, do that. All right, Haley Salvian. Senior writer at The Athletic, women's hockey analyst for CBC. What's up? Did you watch NBA All-Star? Do you care about NBA All-Star?
Yeah.
You did?
I did watch, yeah. Okay. And I think the highlight was Darnell Hillman just being an ultimate hater.
No, I hate him. I fashioned myself an NBA historian when he gave, it was Jacob Toppin, the first dunk, right?
The 46.
Yes. I went, are you kidding me, man? He just went through his legs around and old man Hillman was like, meh.
Whatever.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was like ultimate hater stuff from Hillman and the judges.
It really was.
It got funny towards the end of just like, okay, this is absurd. I thought Mac's first dunk that he got, 46 on from Hillman was unbelievable.
No, I loved that. That was funny to me because Mac McClung obviously needs this, right? He showed up wearing the Orlando G League franchise jersey, and I went, that's where you are, huh? I thought, it's like, I have no idea. Mac McClung, they basically need to be in the G League so that they can break him out for the All-Star weekend. I don't even know what he plays in the G League, whatever. They break him out.
Guard, I don't know.
Yeah, they break him out for the dunk contest, and this is his whole thing. And you know he's practiced all year long, and he does that first dunk, and they go 46, and he had to sweat it out getting to the second round. Had they not robbed Jacob Toppin, he would have been in the second round. I was sitting there laughing my ass off going, this is so cruel that you were going to take away the one thing this guy has and hand it to Jaylen Brown, who basically just did normal dunks that you would see any guy at like a YMCA do.
No, I saw a tweet and it was so true. It was like Jaylen Brown would have been so sick at the 1995 All-Star Game.
He really would have been. He really would have been.
Would have been unreal.
He was very much 95. Wait, so you have a hot take on dunks?
It's not really a hot take. I just, the first dunk when he jumped over Shaq, I was like, okay, that was boring. Like all he did was jump over Shaq. And I know Shaq is a very large man, but I was like, I'm bored of them jumping over people. You need to do a little bit more.
I did like the jump over Shaq dunk, though. And Toppin jumping over his brother.
The two people.
Yeah.
It was better. And then Jaylen Brown jumped over a 6 foot, a 5'8", like, YouTube guy. I was like, what are we?
Yeah, that was, yeah.
What are we
doing
here?
Actually really felt for that YouTube guy because I don't even think he was 5'8". But they just put all over social media, like, this guy, because he's out there with NBA players, right? Nobody knows. Nobody knows what you are. Yeah. You're staying around NBA players. It's normal to look small. And then all of a sudden, the entire internet went, this guy's 5'6". I'd never even heard of that. What is that guy? He's a YouTuber?
I don't know.
I know. I'm old, so old. This was bad. This was my first year where I saw the names on the celebrity list, and basically the only people I knew were the athletes.
Yeah. I saw Kelsey Plum kind of big league a YouTube
that was
funny.
Guy.
And
I
the guy
that
got
moment.
So heated about him. Like, who are you? Like,
I know.
And he was like, you passed the ball, Kelsey Plum. I had more assists than you've had in your career. It's like, you're in the celebrity all-star game, my guy. She plays in the WNBA. It's not the same.
No, but this is a great depiction of where we're at as a society, which is that people YouTube. Think that you can do anything someone else can do because they'll be like, I'll just watch a YouTube video about it. And so that's probably what that guy did, learning how to shoot. And now he thinks he's as good as Kelsey Plum. It's just that's the way it is. Yeah, I know. It is really sad. I hate that YouTuber. I don't know who he is, but I hate his guts. Every moment they showed him, he just made me irrationally mad. I don't know if it was the way he carries himself, the way he spoke, whatever it was. I was driven to near insanity watching that guy, even for 5 seconds. And everybody knows who I'm talking about. Little blonde, short guy with matted down hair at the front who had a painful dialect. Let's just put it that way. Yeah. That's the way he was. Anyway, by the way, Mac McClung, Simon has alerted me to. He's averaging 24 points and 7 assists, 5 rebounds a game in the G League this year. He's a star. So he deserves to be there. He actually deserves to be there. I'm sorry, Mac McClung. In the words of Shaq, I was not familiar with your game. Okay, let's move on to something that actually seemingly mattered this weekend, which was 19,285 people at the Battle of Bay Street. So, obviously, you know, you've dedicated a lot of your time and life to women's hockey. And this journey to get there has been so up and down and rocky and filled with spats and fights and empty arenas and people doubting whether the product could ever be successful and like a million different things, a million different obstacles that were in this thing's way. And all of a sudden it went from, again, failed leagues that had nobody in the building to this. And I know that it's an event city, and so maybe they can't sell 19 every single night for this thing. Everybody understands that. But how has this been so successful so quickly when every other iteration of women's professional hockey has really been so, so difficult to get even a few people in the arena?
A lot of it's about the money, right? Obviously is a huge part of it. I remember writing a big story kind of about the history of women's pro hockey and like what makes this league so significant and different and necessary. And looking back at certain things, like in the CWHL, I think it was like year 15, their expenditures for the year were like $1.2 million. That's the salary cap for one team now. Like the whole league in the past was spending what one team is just spending on salary. So they just weren't spending a lot of money. They didn't have a ton of resources for long periods of time in the sport. The talent was dispersed, right? The CWHL had 6 teams, and then the NWHL launched and had a bunch of teams in the US. And then, you know, there was an exodus of American players to the NWHL. And then there was the PHF and then the PWHPA, and it was about the money and it was about the confusion and, you know, just how all the talent was cut up in between. And I think for a lot of fans, for media people, for just somebody on the street who's like, there's a women's hockey game in there, it was like too confusing and dramatic for people to want to get involved in, right? It was like, why are they fighting? Why are there two leagues? Which PWPH is that? Like,
yeah, it was a nightmare.
Like, honestly, it was just confusing for people to the point where it was prohibitive to get in the door. And that goes for fans and that goes for sponsors and potential investors, right? Like, I've spoken with some sponsors and some league executives who said, you know, pitching, let's just say they're pitching, I won't use any names, I guess they're pitching like one potential sponsor. And the conversation always started with, wait, well, which league are you? Who's in your league? Mm-hmm. Why is there two? And now the pitch is, hey, we've got all the best players in the world in one spot. Mark Walter, the billionaire owner of the Dodgers, he's frontlining this. Stan Kasten's with us. So is Billie Jean King. Marie-Philippe Poulin's, you know, leading the league in scoring. Nat Spooner's here too. Like, the pitch is so much different now, and there's money now, and there's a lot more support. So that really is the biggest thing, and the fact that all the best players in the world are in one space. And there's actual league staff. There's people who work in marketing. There's people who work in ticket sales. Hillary Knight's not trying to sell tickets to her game in Boston anymore. There is, you know, a director of ticketing who works for the league, who works for Boston, whose job is to sell tickets, is to get butts in seats. The games are available on Sportsnet, TSN, CBC. They're on YouTube now. Like, they've somehow figured out blackouts in their first year, right? Like, the games are accessible. And I think, you know, you talk about the 19,000 on Friday, and I was at the game, and it was honestly so cool in the sense that it wasn't even this big deal, because it wasn't like, here's our Friday night showcase, like, special event with the pom-poms and everything. It was like, this is a Friday night game between Toronto and Montreal with 3 points on the line. That just so happens to be at Scotiabank Arena with 19,000 fans, you know, like, it was an event, but this was a regular season game at the end of the day. And I just think, like, they're not going to get 19,000 every night. Like, NHL teams don't always do that. But then they go to Montreal 2 days later, and Montreal sold out their building with over 10,000 fans. So, like, this league is just continuing to prove that there is a market for women's pro hockey when fans and people know that it exists and where it is, and it's, like, easier to get in the door. So I think the money and just getting all the drama kind of removed for the most part has been the biggest path for success. And they've got the right people working at the top, and it just seems a lot more smooth this time around.
Yeah, it's incredible, the difference. Because, okay, I completely understand when contrasting it to I guess the dark period between 2019 and this year, where, you know, CWHL folds. And it's all the stuff with Danny Rylan, and I don't need to go over everything, but it's awful. It was terrible. And I was the same way, where I had almost no appetite for it. And I was like, I can't hear on this anymore, because every time I ask a question to somebody, the answers are so different, and it's always muted with this undertone of like, well, you don't know this part of it, and this person felt this way. Right. And you're like, okay, wow, you really let feelings get in the way of a lot of business. Like, it was really difficult to hear about it or even speak about it. But before that, like, the CWHL ran from what? It was over a decade, right? Like,
12 years,
yeah. Yeah, it was a 12-year league. And yet I went to some of those games, and there was no enthusiasm whatsoever around it. And that's the thing. Sure. I get more money, but those were all the best players in the world that were in one place. And it does feel like maybe something has happened in terms of the profile of some of the players throughout all of the drama that has created something bigger about this game, or maybe some more urgency about this game. Like, I can't quite put my finger on it. I understand the money, and that is huge. But CWHL got put on Sportsnet too, right? Like, I remember... But there was that one finals game, I want to say, that was the last year.
2019.
Yes.
That would have... Yeah.
It was in Calgary, right? And it was just... But I remember the visual of it was horrific, because they put it on TV, and there was no one there for the final. And I'm like, okay, well, if no one's even there, why would anybody be watching this on television? And it's just, the contrast is incredibly stark. There's nothing that I can remember that's like this.
I still think the money is a huge part of it. Like, the players were still working full time. They were never paid, right? So, like, in terms of the product, it's not going to be the same. Like, if, like, take a player out of training full time for a hockey position, and they're not going to be as good of a hockey player, right? So players are being paid now, and that makes a big thing. Like, so even the, like, you know, bottom six, middle six players who in the CWHL would be making zero money, they're not making a ton in this league, but they're at least like a full-time hockey player. They can train and just work at their craft, and the game's going to get better. But I know what you mean. I think part of it is women's sport in general is having a moment, right? And like, women's hockey has been improving. The games are very fun. You've got, you know, young studs coming out of college. Like, Sarah Filliere is not even in this league yet, and she's arguably Canada's best player, not named Marie-Philippe Poulin. She's still in college, right? There's a ton of U.S. players who are still in college who aren't in this league yet. So the game is just getting better. The players are getting better. It's getting more fun. It's getting more fast. People are figuring it out. But yeah, I think it's just part of this like wave that women's professional sport is riding. WNBA numbers are way up. NWSL franchise valuations are up. Like, there are people, like, there are business people getting into women's sport because the ROI makes a lot of sense for them, right? Like, it is cheaper to get in the door with women's pro sport, and you'll get your return on investment quicker than spending, you know, $4 billion on a men's professional sports franchise. Like, we are seeing that happen in women's pro sport now, because the product's good, people are believing in it, and they're just getting it in front of more people. So I really think this is just kind of part of the wave that women's sport's riding right now, you know?
Yeah, so
people were talking about Caitlin Clark during the All-Star game all the time. You know, Sabrina goes out and has that shootout with Steph, and everyone's like, oh, dang, she can shoot. Like, let's get Caitlin Clark next year.
Yeah.
You know, like, people are just talking about, whether it's women's hockey, women's hoops, women's soccer, they're talking about it more. And it's just kind of this big, big wave that they're riding. I think that's a huge part of it.
It's actually going to be really interesting to see what Caitlin Clark does for the WNBA, because she's different
we'll
in terms
how
of
she plays.
No, she'll play well, but that's the thing is, and I'm speaking about this from like now a guy's perspective. Most guys I know don't watch the WNBA. I think that's pretty well established, right? But a lot of guys I know actually care about Caitlin Clark, like are genuinely invested in watching her play basketball. And losing the college sports thing is going to be big, right? Because we all know how to root for college sports. We all know, like, okay, you can tune into Women's March Madness, can tune into the game against LSU. But I do wonder what kind of traction she could actually bring to that league if she starts to just, MJ that sucker. Like, if she shows up and she's just dominant in that league, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a real point of fascination what ends up happening there. But I want to
think it'll be interesting because WNBA players, like, they go into the league and rookies
then disappear,
have a hard time, right? Like, Kelsey Plum set the record when she was at Washington, and it took her like 3 years to really find her way in the league. And I think like the WNBA can sometimes have that like individuality issue of like, you got to go in and like, now you were a stud in college, but you got to go and just like be a rookie and play the system and like be a team player, where like you don't actually just let them go and play their game. Like, it's going to be interesting to see what Caitlin Clark does, like in a different system where she's told like, you got to earn your spot.
No, they shouldn't do that. So, they should just say,
no, they shouldn't.
They should just
they should
say,
let her
hey,
just ball
you
and
can change our league. Actually,
watch,
you're the, cause like all due respect to Kelsey Plum, I never once had a Kelsey Plum conversation outside of look how far she can throw the t-shirt at the basketball game into the crowd. Like that
she,
was the number one
should,
Kelsey Plum.
Watch her.
I've seen her play. She went to Washington. Like, that's the team I'm a fan of. I was aware of who she was before. I'm saying, like, it didn't reach a point of, you know, this is getting to dudes. This is not.
Yeah.
Dudes are not caring about where Kelsey Plum plays in the WNBA. She goes to a team and guys go, yep, we don't care. That was cool in college, and now it's over. Caitlin Clark is going to be a totally different animal in terms of people going, okay, what is that the Caitlin Clark team will be a thing people say. And they will know where she plays.
They should let her play.
Yeah, they'll know where she plays. But, okay, I remember a couple of years ago I talked to Jessica Berman, the commissioner of the NWSL, about expansion in Canada. And I was like, oh, you know, when are you going to get a Toronto team here, Because there was a lot of hype about that. And she told me something that was really smart that none of us really think about, which is you got to grow these leagues slowly. And the biggest risk you can do is try to jump and create something too fast, right? But you're already seeing this buzz, and I read your article up on The Athletic about Friday night's game and how, hey, they're selling out Mattamy. And what's Mattamy? 2,000, like a little under 3,000?
2,600.
Yeah, okay. So it's too small. It feels anyways, it's a little too small. Because if you want to go to this game, the one thing it cannot be is like all the other games, which is cost prohibitive, right? That was my one issue about Friday night, is I'm looking at ticket sales and it basically cost you 100 US to sit anywhere in the 300s if you wanted to buy a ticket late. You look at the Mattamy pricing and it's
Was that on resale?
Yeah, that's on resale. But again, most people are not dialed into this. Most people want to figure it out after. Resale is the way that tickets get done now. Like if someone buys a ticket in advance for something like a concert, a game, and anything, I'm like, whoa, you're the world's biggest fan of this, huh? Like,
I got Avril Lavigne tickets.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is you're the world's biggest fan of that thing. Anyways, so but is there a case, can they figure out a way to get this product to Rico? Because I would kind of think that that is the ideal situation moving forward here, where somebody like me goes, actually, I'd like to go, but I'm not going to spend, $200 to go see it, because this, it's competitive in this city for a ticket. I need this to be cheaper. I need this to be more accessible. I want to see more butts in the seats. When does this have that conversation, or is that conversation already happening?
Yeah, I just pulled up like a ticket reseller, and tickets to go see a game at Mattamy are like $300 on.
That's what I mean.
Websites,
there's no chance. That's like, no chance anybody's
that's
doing
wild,
that.
Wild, wild, wild.
Nobody's doing that.
Yeah, I think I spoke with Jaina Hefford, who's the senior vice president of hockey operations with the league, kind of about this. And, you know, they're happy at Mattamy. They think it's a great atmosphere. They love the downtown location, and they've made it pretty clear they have no interest in leaving like the downtown core, right? Like, they're not going to go to Brampton. They're not going to go to Mississauga. I think that would be a mistake. Obviously, you want to be downtown Toronto. And so if you're looking, for an arena upgrade, it's going to come by Coca-Cola Coliseum. Rico,
oh, whoops, sorry.
Or,
I forgot that's what it's called now. Yeah.
Awkward.
Yeah, no,
or Scotiabank Arena, right?
I still call that ACC.
You know, for, yeah, for sure. It's Sky Dome, whatever.
Yeah.
And she kind of just said, like, everything's on the table in terms of what we're looking at for season two, right? And I think the kind of company line from the PWHL is, yes, we want to grow, but we can't do it too rapidly. Kind of what you said of, like, we don't want to get ourselves into an arena that ends up feeling cavernous, or that we can't fill it. But at the same time, you don't want to put a cap on how many people get into the building or make it prohibitive to get into the door, as you're saying, right? It's like, I would love to go and see a PWHL Toronto game on a Tuesday night, but the ticket's $300 on StubHub or Ticketmaster, resell, or whatever it may be. So I do think they need to look for kind of the next step. And I think Rico or Coca-Cola is the most obvious one, in my opinion. It's what I think it's just under 8,000 for a hockey game when it's the Marlies. I think that's the right number. I think, you know, if you can sell half of that, it's not going to look super empty, because it's kind of a more intimate venue, even though it is bigger than Mattamy. I think the issue with an arena like that, it's a heritage building, like that whole complex. So in terms of like making any kind of renovations that would be necessary to host a full-time women's pro hockey team, it's a little bit more difficult. You know, do they have full-time locker room for a PWHL team? Is there a visitor locker room already there? Like, they're not going to use the Marlies room. Like, that is their space, right? So is there two more locker rooms for a women's pro hockey team and the away team to use? Is there a training facility in there? How difficult is it to build those things if they're not already there? Like, those are the big questions. And then I think, as people probably listening to this know, like, from Toronto, there's the Royal Winter Fair in the boat show. I did game ops for the Marlies. Like, I'd like threw t-shirts and stuff for a little bit when I was in school. It was super fun. But like, we just wouldn't have any games for like a month because the Royal Winter Fair was on. And it was just like, hey, the Marlies are on the road for 3.5 weeks. We'll see you in March or whatever. I don't know when I don't know when the Royal Winter Fair actually is. but those are things that you'd have to play into it, right? Like, you can't have a pro team in the city that you're trying to get excitement around and then just be like, they actually aren't here for the next month.
Yeah.
Good luck. Try to see them on the road. So I do think that will, I think that's their best option. I think that's better than trying to get in at Scotiabank and just covering up the uppers and trying to fill the lower bowl. But I think we'll see what happens. But I do think that game, the biggest thing I think it did was like confirm that the Toronto team can consistently play somewhere bigger than Mattamy. But yeah. I know the league is very happy there, and they're not ruling kind of anything out heading into their next season.
To me, that's just a simple one is you go, hey, when the Royal Winter Fair is there, you just go back to Mattamy and you hang out there for a while. And then when it's gone, you go back and play your games at Coca-Cola Stadium.
When is that? I guess it's at the wintertime.
Yeah, it's in the wintertime. I don't know. The only reason that I even know it exists, and I've lived here for, a long time.
Big horse guy?
No, is that I have a friend who works in agriculture, and so every year he comes and visits, and it's always during this, and that's the only reason I know it exists, is he went, oh, yeah, that was a big thing, and I went, oh, yeah, I guess so. Like, I have no idea. I don't know why I'm supposed to know that or how I would ever know that otherwise. Like, I bet you there's a lot of people listening to this right now in this demo
like
that are just discovering what this is
idiots.
And Googling what it is. No, I think that they're figuring out along that this is an actual thing that happens in the city. Yes.
It's like very popular. No, there's a lot of people who
I'm not saying
that.
It's
there's
not popular.
Being like, you're dumb.
No, there are
How
some people who are saying I'm dumb.
From November 2nd to 13th.
No. That's not. There's nobody who says that November 2nd. They're like, yeah, no, that's unless you are directly working the floor, you have no clue that it starts November 2nd. And I'm sure that that's not even every single year. Maybe it is. Maybe November 2nd. They're like, you know what time it is. It's like the X. You'll just get like, yes, it's here. Okay. You covered the Calgary Flames for a very long time.
That's right.
It was your second beat, right?
That's right.
Yeah, second beat. So you're the person to ask. Don't laugh. This is a real thing. And I know you're connected, and you don't let on how connected you are. You let it kind of lurk and then pick your spots. And, you know, you're quiet about it. You're a lurker. You're quiet about what you know. So... let me ask you this. You covered Brad Treeling for years in Calgary. How do you think he's going to approach this deadline watching this Leafs team?
I think it's been pretty clear that they are aggressively looking for a defender, right? I think the biggest thing about Brad Treeling that I can maybe share from my time in Calgary is that, you know, I don't know if there's been like a big press conference yet ahead of the trade deadline. I don't believe so. I think he spoke briefly about the Morgan Riley thing. But if there is going to be a Treeling presser ahead of the deadline where people say, what's going to be your philosophy ahead of the deadline? You can probably bet you're going to hear something along the lines of, I like to take my cues from my team. That is the big Brad Treeling line around this time of year, right? Is like my team and how they are playing is going to dictate what I do and how I do my job this time of year. Right. And I think what's interesting is the Calgary Flames. While I was there, it was either like, oof, like sell Sam Bennett, like move out of UFA or stand pat, don't do anything, just see what happens. Cause they were very middling, you know, fighting for a wild card spot or like kind of out of it and not going to make the playoffs. Or, you know, the final year I was in Calgary where they were one of the best teams in the Western Conference. You know, Johnny Gaudreau's Hart Trophy candidate, Matthew Tkachuk still there, Jacob Markstrom, Vezina candidate, everything is, you know, happy and awesome. And, you know, Brad was more aggressive at the deadline, you know, particularly early, bringing in Tyler Toffoli on Valentine's Day. Then they bring in Cali Yarncroke, who's now on the Leafs, of course. So I think I've seen the two sides of Brad Treeling of like, I'm not going to do anything here because like you guys aren't playing well enough. Like this is not a team worth adding to and it's not worth spending assets on. And then I've seen a more aggressive Brad Treeling at the trade deadline. He hasn't been like a huge rentals guy. Obviously bringing in Toffoli, he had term Yarncroke, I believe was a pending unrestricted free agent when they brought him in, but I don't think the spend was too much. Like I don't think they gave up a first for him. And I think and if they did the Kraken retained salary, I don't know the details of that trade, but you know, he wasn't a big rentals guy in my time with Calgary. But I think like, and you don't have to cover the Flames to know this. I think everyone says this about Brad Treeling is he's always working the phones. He's like very aggressive and shopping and just getting the vibe of everyone, you know, just saying like, hey, what are you looking for? Hey, like, what do you think about this guy? Like he's a very active general manager in the sense that he's always calling other GMs. And my colleague at The Athletic, Pierre LeBrun's been reporting for a while now that like he's been very aggressive and looking for a defender. The blue line search has been a very real thing in Toronto, if you kind of believe the insiders. I think what Pierre said previously was that it's going to take a first rounder to get like a Chris Tanev from Calgary. So like if they're that far down the road, they're having those conversations of like, what do I need to do to get Chris in Calgary? And it seems like it's been, yeah, you got to give us a first round pick. Pierre also said the Leafs have called on guys like Sean Walker and Alexandre Carrier from the Preds. So obviously if you're taking the whole cues from my team thing, like I don't know if I have seen like a Leafs team that's worth like going all in on. Personally, I think this Leafs team is good, not great. But I think the obvious cue is like, if he's going to add, it needs to be on the blue line because it is like weak. And we had this conversation early in the season and you're like, what do you think about the Leafs? I think their blue line kind of sucks. I'm worried about their blue line and goaltending this season. And so that's obviously a cue that Brad is taking from his team, is that this blue line's not good enough. And then I think that they have, that they're, you know, more top heavy this year than usual because the secondary scoring hasn't been there consistently throughout the season. So I think the other thing would be just trying to beef up the bottom six. But and the goaltending's been inconsistent. So when I look at those three things, like, are you going to fix all three of those at the trade deadline? Are you really going to spend all these assets trying to fix A, B, and C at the deadline? Or should you just kind of stand pat with what you have and try to fix your mistakes in the summer? Like, that's where I get a little bit stuck. And that's not like an insight into Bradtree living per se. That's just like thinking aloud about this team. They've won three in a row. They're 7-3 in their last 10. They're third in the Atlantic. Sure. Like, this is not a bad team, but like, do you think you can fix all those things?
No, here's the thing. People, I don't think anybody is still on the Tanev thing, and maybe they do that. But to me, it's Tanev comes over with something else because, yeah, the idea of giving up a first-round pick for a 34-year-old who, is a pending free agent is just seemingly a non-starter, especially for this group, right? You said it is. If you're going to do the rental thing, and Tree Living did that with Yarncroc, but it was also salary retention. It was a second and a third.
Yeah.
And it was 50% salary for Yarncroc. But this is not that team. It's very clear that this is not that team, and everybody kind of knows that. The only thing to me is they've got... If you're talking about let the team dictate it, I don't really care about this stretch. And some people are going to overstate it, overrate it, whatever the hell. I don't care if you beat up on the crappy Ducks team. It's nice that you do that because you don't always do it. That's good for the standings.
Yeah, then we don't have to talk about why can't the Leafs beat the
Correct, Ducks. Correct. But ultimately, before the deadline, they have a game against the Rangers, two against the Bruins, two against Vegas, one against Colorado. These are going to be the games now that actually matter. If Toronto can do something in these and actually show something, then I wonder how much more aggressive Tree Living gets. If they show what they have in the past against some of these teams, then I think that it's a pretty stand-pat position, or a pretty clear stand-pat position they take. The question is, when you're talking about, hey, do you do all your stuff in the offseason? I think the only way that they're moving that first is if it's for somebody that helps them get some business done ahead of the offseason. And now that conversation...
Like center, someone with term, you mean?
Or somebody like Noah Hanifin, who has become the real... But that's it. That's the guy that everybody's talking about now. And people don't know, seemingly, whether or not he actually will want to sign another Canadian market or what's going to go on in Calgary. But the word is that it's 7x7+. He's not one of the best defensemen in the NHL. He would certainly slot in very high with the Leafs. You'd have two left-shot guys as your top two pairings.
I think he's a true top pair.
You think he's a true top pair? Okay. Because I was going to say, that's the other part is, you've watched this guy a lot. Do you like the fit there? Is he somebody that you would want to put with this core on a 7x7.5 or a little under?
I think it's a little bit tough because I think some of Hanifin's best hockey that I saw was when he was on a pair with Chris Tanev, and you kind of have to like try to remove Tanev and say how much did he carry that. But I think Hanifin is like Hanifin's interesting because he's one of those guys that is like good at everything, but not elite at one specific thing. Does that make sense? Like, Tanev is like the best defensive defender on the market, right? So if you want that like rugged veteran who's just going to get pucks out of the zone, he's got a good stick. Like, I think to appreciate Chris Tanev is to watch Chris Tanev every day, because there's so many little things that he does. Like, the stick details are great. Like, that's not a super sexy thing. You're not noticing that on a highlight reel. But when you're watching him, it's just like, oh my gosh, he's just like clinical in the way that he can get possession of the puck in the zone, get it up to the forwards and out of the D zone into the offensive zone. Like, he is elite at that. Whereas Noah Hanifin's like a good defensive defender. He's a good offensive defender. He can exit the zone. He's very good, but not elite at, like, he's very good at a lot, but not elite at one specific thing. So I think that makes him a little bit more of like a versatile fit where it's like, do we want to put him on the top pair? Do we want to make him, do we want to load up a top pair? Do we want to put him on the second pair to give us a more well-balanced top four? Like, I think Noah Hanifin can kind of slot in wherever you want within the top four. But I think, you know, in terms of his all-around game, I think he is like a true quote-unquote top pair defender. Mm. I think he's probably the only like true top pair guy available at the deadline, unless you want to look at a Jacob Chychrun or a Sean Walker. Mm. And obviously Chris Tanev is like the best defensive defender in my opinion, but I don't know if people are saying like that's our number one D because he's 34 and da da da. But yeah, I would like a Noah Hanifin fit in Toronto. I think, yeah, the question is, do you want to spend if he's just going to want to sign like in an American market? Is he going to want to go? He's a Boston guy. Like, is he going to want to sign at home? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that part you can't handle. But if you get a read on it where he will sign here, that's the evaluation you have to make, is how he fits with the core, because it doesn't seem the core is changing because all of them got no move clause and all of the money. Anyway, Haley Salvian, senior writer at The Athletic, women's hockey analyst for CBC. Thanks as always for making the time.
Yeah, thanks.
See you later. Okay, so I got lots of thoughts on Matthews. Everybody's talking about Matthews. I'm going to do that tomorrow. I got Craig Simpson on. So I'll discuss the evolution of his game a little bit. And I think that there's now a little percolation of, hey, can he get in the heart conversation despite being like 20 points back of Kucherov and guys at the very top? But the goal scoring is now he's separating himself from the pack so greatly. Plus his meaning to this team, if we're doing the MVP thing, might be most important. But yeah, as of right now, I still think, you know, we're less than a month away from the trade deadline and everybody every day is doing Calgary, Calgary, Calgary. That's the team that has the pieces. Let's just say I'm watching way more Calgary now. They're my number two team as I really try to shore up this opinion. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's come back. Awesome weekend in the UFC, winners and losers.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
I might need a little more time for this at the end of the show. But UFC 298 was a banger. UFC 300 is an announcement. Ooh. Yeah. You knew it wasn't going to be great when Dana White said that he was going to announce what the main event for UFC 300 was at 1 o'clock in the morning. That was a bad sign. And yet no one thought it was going to be that bad. Sorry, but the UFC 300 card is a massive disappointment for fans that had been waiting a very, very long time for that thing to get set up beautifully. I will say this, though. 298 was brilliant. 299 I would rather pay for than 300 as well. So this is just this is what happens when you have the spreading out of talent and putting stars on different cards instead of just trying to load up a 300 event. And Ariel came on last week and he said it. They think they can sell 300 because of the number. That it'll do bonkers numbers just because it's UFC 300. I'm praying for my boy Max Holloway. Please don't get hurt against Justin Gaethje. I hate that he's in that fight. I hate so much that Max Holloway is just in there against Gaethje and the idea is just to exchange between those two. Spooks me. Please, just come out of there alive, Max. But 298, okay? Winners and losers. I'm definitely going to do more of this later. Number one is the Georgians. The Georgians at a moment. The Georgians are here. They've arrived. What a moment. Topuria was better than advertised, and I've seen him fight before, but Volkanovski is an all-time great champion. And yes, he's 35 years old, and yes, they played up the old guy thing, and Simon, you said it, like, can't be playing the old guy thing and then get starched. Can't get knocked out and folded up.
That's tough.
I don't know why Joe Rogan spoke to him afterwards when he said that he was never going to do that again with knocked out guys after the Cormier thing, but whatever. Topuria was brilliant, but Merab was arguably an even bigger breakout for the UFC. Like, you have two guys, two Georgian superstars that made massive impacts on Saturday night, and both now are going to be stars moving forward. I would think have a little bit more casual appeal moving forward. And so That's just the number one thing to me. I can't believe how much Tuporia is borrowing from the Connor playbook to the point where he's like got the tattoo on his back. He looks like he's crisp like him as a boxer. He's a brilliant fighter. He's trying to do the belt grab move.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got a country of Spain behind him, which is cool because we haven't had like a nasty Spanish guy in the UFC before. I think it's a massive, massive win for the UFC. Anyway, I'm going to get into this more because I have a ton of thoughts on this weekend, including some losers. But man, oh man, to have that kind of showboating and trash talking and just honest to goodness, great fighting was brilliant for the UFC this past weekend. Anyways, quick break. Let's come back. Let's talk to Dan Bylsma. I'll never forgive the Leafs for ruining HBO's 24/7 series. Apparently they were just such a pain in the ass to deal with that HBO just went, you know what? That's enough. We're good. We're good. The editors at the Toronto Maple Leafs wouldn't relent. Our next guest had still one of my favorite quotes ever from that series. He's the head coach of the Coachella Valley Firebirds, Stanley Cup champion, Jack Adams winner, Stan Bylsma. How's it going, man?
I'm great. I'm curious as to what the quote is.
You know what the quote is. It's such a good quote. I'm sure people have said it to you a million times. Can you guess?
I'm not sure.
It's where you were like, I was a hockey player. It's like, damn, that's a cool ass thing to say. It's like, I like my scars, shows I was a hockey player. I remember watching that, getting chills, going, that's how you become a head coach in the league. If you say that to guys, then all of a sudden they're trying to block shots with their face going, I got to get one of those. Like, my only scar from hockey is my friend Shane closed my pinky finger in the van door one time after practice. That's the only one I ever got. It hurt, though. Like, it hurt like a son of a bitch, man. I'm telling you, it was bad.
Yeah, that's actually a common minor hockey injury.
Yeah, Van Dorn.
The old finger in the car door. Yeah.
I'll never forget, too, he didn't want to open the door because he was afraid my finger was going to fall off. And I was like, please open the door, because it was my left hand. Like, I couldn't get across. I was just there stunned, only pinky finger in the door, no rest of hand. Not a good one. My finger was definitely hanging. Not as cool of a hockey scar as yours. So, you're with the Kraken affiliate right now. You're first in the Pacific Division. Your team's red hot, so congratulations on that. But
yes,
seriously, how do you keep guys focused when you're in Palm Springs and it's most known for golf courses and you're coaching hockey players?
That's how you do it.
Yeah.
I think
a lot of golf trips, a lot of team bonding on the course.
Yeah, clearly right now Coachella is ideal destination for the American Hockey League. As we speak right now, I'm walking out in 65 degree morning weather, and the mountains are out behind, the palm trees, and a golf course is within eyesight right now. So it's a great place to come and play hockey.
Mm-hmm. It's minus 13 in Toronto today. It's windy. It's dark. It's not as good. It's really, yeah, Palm Springs, that's nice. That's probably feels pretty good being there. I could be down for a quick trip. Although I really screwed up Palm Springs when I was there. Actually, the first time I was there, I was a kid, and I decided to do the celebrity tour. I got on a bus. I was there by myself. I was at a cousin's baseball tournament, and I was like, oh, celebrity tour, this sounds cool. But it's like when the celebrities live there, they're all from like the 1930s. And I was a kid on a bus with a bunch of, you know, elderly people, a bunch of blue hairs watching like where Dean Martin lived. And I had no idea who any of these people were. They're like, this person played Catwoman in 1942. And I went, okay, get off the bus. We're going to look at her headstone. Big mistake. Big mistake by me. But okay, you are really in this interesting position. It's very like, I don't want to say Ted Lasso-ish, but there's something very cool about getting to be the head coach of an expansion team in a non-traditional market. Like, you know, this thing comes together, you become the head coach. I'm curious how it's been different from your other experiences, given that, yeah, this thing got started from scratch.
Yeah, totally from scratch. Expansion team, new team, you know, new area, new building, new fans. I had no idea really the success we would have with the community and the fans, and obviously in a non-traditional market.
Mm-hmm.
So it was ground up. It was a new beginning in a lot of ways for the players, also for myself, and it's been it's been awesome to you know, you don't necessarily put together a team. It's Ron Francis, the Kraken, and Jason Bottrell. Expansion draft was a part of it a couple years ago, but you know, we're a new organization, and so we don't have many drafts to have. So we were kind of like an expansion team. We were free agents, and again, players from the expansion draft were coming to to our organization. But it was a completely new experience, and it was a great one to build from the ground up, and what we've created here in Coachella Valley with the weather, the fans, the community, the building. It's a special place, and then in turn, we've had a special team the last year and a half, winning a lot of hockey games.
Well, it's cool because, you know, getting to build a new team, you get to try to do things differently, right? You get to try and impose the changes that you would maybe want to see and try to leave certain stuff behind. But I would imagine still, though, as a head coach, when you're just focused on winning in your group and, you know, you've got player development, that's a huge part of what you've got to do at the AHL level. Does all the other stuff that has surrounded being a team that start from scratch make your job harder? Like, how has it been from a practical standpoint for you?
The whole organization was new and new to hockey in a lot of ways. We, you know, from a building of the team to to travel to training camp to it was new for everyone. We're bringing people to the hockey for the first time, so there wasn't an infrastructure built into the team. There wasn't how to do things. There wasn't you know, this is what we've done in the past. This is how the Firebirds have done it, and this is how we're doing it. It was you start from literally square one with everything and everyone. And there was, you know, last year in particular, we started without a building being finished until December 18. We played 22 games away from Coachella Valley. Oof. Started in Seattle for a month and a half and played a few home games up in Seattle, but we had 22 games away from the Valley to start the season. So there was a lot to ask of the players. It was a lot to ask of the group. And we definitely had, you know, some growing pains, but I think they were positives for the team, and they're positives for the organization.
Well, it's also cool too. There's something about being a hockey person and a hockey fan, especially in a market like that, where when you bring someone into the game and they have that initial excitement for it, of discovering it, where you really, like, hockey is very different from the other sports in that way, where it's like you get excited seeing someone else learn about the game or come to the game in a different way from the other sports. And, like, that's always felt like a bit of a Canadian thing, where we really nationalize our sport. We always really want, whenever America gives us a little bit of attention. But I'm sure, too, as an American who's been in it his entire life, there's that added feeling of it, too. Like, hey, this is an awesome sport. You should be watching this sport. This isn't a niche sport. And you get excited when you're in a market like that, too, or there's some kind of reinvigorization for you seeing, yeah, people experience this for the first time. Like, is that the same way, or is that more of a Canadian thing?
It was really quite unique over the course of all of last year, and we're seeing the benefits of it this year in our fans. But we stepped off the plane in December 18 to come to Coachella Valley, and we didn't quite know what we were going to get in terms of our fans in the community. And we, as you mentioned about the population in Palm Springs, in the area,
it's older.
We had there's an older population, and there's snowbirds, and we thought we might get a group of fans that were snowbirds and Canadians, and we have a lot of people from Seattle that come down here in the winter, and so that's what we saw at first. We saw you know, a building with snowbirds. We saw a lot of plates from Alberta, Manitoba, we saw British Columbia. We saw a lot of those car license plates in the parking lot. And as the season went on, you saw more and more people from the community, from Southern California. You saw Ducks jerseys and Kings jerseys. You saw Shark jerseys. And And at the end of the season, we go into playoffs, and as you know, the 180 days is up, and we were losing a lot of the fans that we had during the season, but they were being replaced by people from the area that were coming to hockey maybe for the first time, mm-hmm. or had been distant fans of the teams in the area, the teams in California, but didn't have a hockey team of their own. And by the end of the playoffs, the building was filled with young, old, new fans. And it was a completely different atmosphere, almost, a Vegas-type atmosphere to the building. And it was great to see just a whole different realm of fans coming to our games. And the atmosphere of our games is pretty special. Not, it's not maybe a traditional hockey atmosphere. It's mm-hmm. more of a more got a soccer feel to not quite as great as soccer fans are, but a little bit more like a soccer feel to the energy of the fans.
That's great. And, you know, we established that you're a hockey lifer. Like, you've been around the game as a player, a coach, and long time that you've been doing this. And yeah, but we spend a lot of time right now talking about, hey, the state of the game and where it's going and why it's happening this way. And I've had guests on talking about, you know, professionalization of youth sports and the way that's impacted a sport like hockey that for a long time had a passion quotient that I think was a little bit bigger than maybe it is right now. But you're now with an AHL team where it's a younger group, right? And I know you've got some older players. I know you've got some vets on that team, like, you know, for some people, former Leaf Connor Carrick's with your team. But coaching younger players, are you noticing like a significant difference in terms of the way young guys need to be coached? Do we overstate that as outsiders right now? Like, has the game from a coaching standpoint changed as dramatically as we in the media and some outsiders make it seem from time to time? Like, what has been your experience with that?
It's a good question. And, I think that I don't see the players entering the game now or the younger generation being the things that have changed. I feel like the things that have changed is the coaching. If we're talking about going back 10 years and going back 20 years, I think I think it's probably the coaches that have needed to change and that have changed and that are coaching differently than 20 years ago. I don't know, maybe that's because it needed to change, or maybe that does mean the generation has changed and that these players need to be coached differently. But I don't see the coaching that I got. Maybe let's just go all the way back to when I started and talking in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I don't see that type of coaching or the type of coaching that I got work very well.
Okay.
I think it's we have changed, and I think that's a good thing. I think I love coaching in the American Hockey League. These players have a place to go. They have a clear goal in mind. We're developing them. They want to get to the NHL, and they want to get better, and they want to have the answers. And I think as a coach, you have to provide it for them, and not just open the gate, not just blow the whistle for practices. You got to provide them with the answer, because they have a high motivation level to get to where they want to go, which is the National Hockey League.
Yeah, I just, when I, the way it seems to be going, like, obviously there's some things that did need to change, and that's happened in all of sports. But usually there's like a period of overcorrection, and I wonder if we are in a little bit of that time period now, especially when you're maybe not as heavily as the AHL level for you right now. Like, I'm sure that you're comparing and contrasting, or that you have at least in certain points, because yeah, you do hold a lot more power in terms of sway of who is going to get a call up to hit their ultimate dream, their ultimate point of destination. But that, yeah, it's gone from more of a, the power dynamic of a coach has certainly shifted. Like, outside of the just, you know, ability to, I'm trying to think of a word outside of, you know, the way I want to say it with a player. But I think everybody can kind of get the gist of what I'm trying to drive at here. But that maybe it's more of trying to figure out, like, connecting with the players in a different way, but establishing that authority. Like you just said it of, you know, giving them the answers, giving them the tools. That maybe the power dynamic has shifted more from like player coach to partnership between the coach and the players.
That may be a good way to look at it. I just looking back in my career, there's some skills and there are some things that I learned at 26 and 27 and 29 years old that I was well into my professional career and you know, made the NHL at 26 and 27, and I'm learning things about the game, about skating, about the game that I had never been taught, I've never been told. And I've had a lot of coaches in the path of professional hockey, but there's lots of things that I had to figure out on my own. I didn't get those from my coach. I had to do it through, you know, trial and error, and I had to do it, you know, butt my head up against the wall, so to speak. And as a coach, I view it my role to whether it's be a partner, but I'm their help to get to where they want to go. I'm their help to get to be the kind of player they want to be.
Mm. Yeah. It sounds like it's harder to coach now. It sounds like it's way harder to coach now. Like that answer, I'm going, God, this is hard. This is really, really hard what he's got to do. Okay, so the original reason that I wanted to have you on was because the Olympics were coming back to hockey, and I was trying to think about like who would be cool to chat with about those times. And then I was looking at, you know, what you're doing right now, and I'm like, oh, I got to talk to him about a bunch of these things because this is pretty fascinating itself. But you know, it's sad because you were the last head coach of the U.S. men's hockey team, and it's been a decade since we've had best on best hockey at the Olympics. And I'm sorry, with all due respect to the tournament that we tried to throw here in Toronto with the under 21 team or the young gun team and the Team Europe mismatch. It's just, it wasn't it. And everybody knew it in the city right away. It didn't pass the smell test, and that's why people weren't going. And it wasn't really a celebrated event that had a long life cycle. But yeah, it's going to be 2026. So 12 years, two missed cycles is what we're going to end up having. What did you think of when you first heard that it was returning? Like, what is it going to mean to U.S. hockey, especially that has been chomping at the bit to show how much they've closed the gap between, teams from the past and the Canadian teams of now?
I think for hockey, it would be tough to find someone who said the Stanley Cup wasn't the biggest prize,
of course,
in our sport. But I think a gold medal in the Olympics is equally as it's right there with that answer of the Stanley Cup being the greatest. A gold medal in the Olympics is a special thing. It's a special tournament, and it's I think everybody wants to see that, or you know, it's not always been able to do it, but everybody wants to see that best on best, represent your country. Olympics gold medal is as special as, you know, winning the Stanley Cup. So to hear that we were going to be able to have it returned to our nations, and you're going to be able to represent your country in the Olympics, and the chance to win a gold medal is, you know, it's, it's one of the greatest things. It's one of the greatest stories in our sports, that, you know, at least this for us in the U.S., 1980 in the U.S., winning the gold medal in Lake Placid. So it's super pumped to be able to have the Olympics back and to have it be best on best. And it creates a great story, and it creates some great anticipation for what we're going to see with the best players in the world competing and competing for a gold medal.
Well, it's especially interesting here because, for the last, these last two cycles, USA Hockey has gained on Canada in a very noticeable way. Like, you're seeing it pretty much every year at the juniors. You're seeing it every year at the draft. You're especially seeing it because now we're back to creating fake rosters of who we think is going to be on each team. And you look at the American side, and you're like, whoa, that's way better than it used to be. That's actually pretty terrifying considering the way that things used to go. And I think back to Sochi. The thing about that was Canada was just, to me anyways, I don't know, you probably feel about it differently being the coach of the Americans, but the gap between Canada and the rest of the countries, I don't think has ever been that stark. Like, the blue line Canada had, I still think is the best that'll ever be assembled. The dominance they had in that tournament was incredible. Again, you guys had a talented team, but how has USA Hockey taken such a step forward over the course of the last decade, where we've gone from, hey, this is not a conversation, to, oh my God, they might win?
That's exciting for me.
Yeah, it's not for me. I hate it. I don't even like hearing you laugh like that. Like, this is over. This interview is over. No, but seriously, how does this happen?
Well, I think, it's still the challenge for Canada. It's like, I feel like we were talking about it with the guys in the room a couple weeks ago. And it would be a challenge to put together a third team for Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Canada's, Canada's still
deeper.
Probably deeper, and to put a team together for Canada is extremely difficult. You're going to be leaving off some great hockey players, and you could have a second team, and you could have a third team with the roster that Canada has. But I think, now. Maybe in the past, maybe 2014, we had a lot of tough choices and we left some really, really good hockey players off. But now you could start to think about putting a second and a third team together for the U.S. and you still have good hockey players to round out. And so I think the quality of the player and the depth of the player, you look at down the middle and you're like, whoa, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. That's not pretty good. That might be, equally as good as staring across at McDavid. And so you have the depth and the quality, and there's going to be a lot of tough choices. There's going to be great players that don't make the U.S. team. And it's, right down the lineup for the defensemen and the goaltending. And so you're looking at just awesome, and the depth of the pool is a lot deeper now, and it's amazing to see where over the course of the last 10 years the program in Ann Arbor and the World Juniors, the depth of USA Hockey continues to get deeper and deeper, and that just means you guys have a bigger pool of quality of players at the top.
Yeah. As a Canadian hockey fan, I hate it. And it really does. It is scary. I want it. I really hope Canada in 2026 beats the brakes off you guys and that we can sort of put this to bed for a little while. But as of right now, I will say that this is by far the closest that it's ever looked in terms of a top end talent between the two teams and going roster for roster. And actually, the year you coached, it was famous for the TJ Sochi thing, if people remember that.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, she just nonstop in the taking advantage of the rules of being able to shoot the shootout like over and over and over again and being nasty. But people, I think, will very easily forget that Phil Kessel was the leading points getter at that tournament. He's in Vancouver right now trying to attempt a comeback bid. And listen, this would be a failure of me if I didn't try to ask someone who coached Phil Kessel at a tournament he was having a lot of success at. if they had a good Phil Kessel story from the time coaching him?
Well, I don't have a great one. I was super excited, curious to coach Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Phil's got a lot of notoriety, and there are a bunch of stories about Phil. But I was I actually was amazed at just the quality of player that he is, the speed that he has, and the puck skills, and his shot coming off the wing, and he was enlightening to see in person. He was a extremely good hockey player, and he has it he's just got a quiet, little bit smug way about himself with a voice that you turn your head at and look at it.
I was going to say, are you not going to do the voice? Because everybody does the voice whenever they tell a story.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
It's head turning though. It is head turning.
Yeah. I love everybody does the voice. Like whenever there's a story, people can't resist actually doing it. And it's my favorite because almost everybody's spot on. Like somehow it's an easy voice to do. I think that there's something about him that's very much like, you know how baseball players or let's just not even say baseball players. A lot of athletes used to like smoke cigarettes, right? And we were like, oh my God, that's so crazy that so many guys who smoke cigarettes. And I think with Phil, one of our fascinations beyond the voice is that it's the confidence of a guy like that, like where he'll step up to Ryan Reeves and be like, yeah, I can beat you in basketball, no problem. And he steps up, he's terrible at it. And watching the video said he's got this insane amount of confidence that he is a great athlete, like across all sports. Apparently, like, you know, you put him in a ping pong tournament, he's incredible, golf, all these different things. But yeah, the confidence, but also that it's like a throwback diet of someone who will be like, you know, there's a story here of he was basically telling the Leafs, like, if you take away the soda machines, he's not going to play hockey. You know, it's just, there's not too many guys like that anymore that are drinking as many like sodas as a guy like Phil Kessel.
A Snickers and a soda between periods. Yeah. I was told about it and I was looking for it.
But you got to let it happen when he's leading your team in scoring. And you go like, yeah, I guess. Get him another Snickers. Get it in here. Hurry up. Hustle up.
Yeah, you know, the European tournaments usually provide you with a unique display of the candy or the chocolate or the flair of the nation you're in. So it wasn't Snickers and it was soda, but it wasn't Snickers, but it was might have been Nutella and some other form of chocolate in between periods, but it was there.
Yeah,
so that's Phil.
So I got two more guys I want to talk to you about that you coached. One is a guy that's playing here right now who's been struggling to produce and who had two of his best seasons with you when you were in Detroit as an assistant. Tyler Bertuzzi, he finally scored the other night, and I think he had gone something stupid like 18 games without a goal. It had just been an annoyance for him because he does a lot of things well, but he just wasn't finishing around the net. But again, you were there the two seasons that he broke out, and he scored 20 in both. I'm curious what you thought was the best way to get the best out of Tyler Bertuzzi.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we talked about coaching and screaming and yelling and putting him out the door is probably not the best way for Tyler, but he's also one who he needs to feel good to play good. He's an emotional player, as in when you're emotional, you feel good. You feel good about yourself. You feel good about your game. You play your best. And he's a competitor, and his strengths are his competitiveness and his nature. And he's a bit of it's not the prettiest game.
Mm-hmm.
It's scrappy and it's battling and he's got to feel good about him. He's got to feel good about his game, and you're going to get a high compete level. It may not be the prettiest game in the planet, but his skills don't jump off the table at you as, you know, if you're putting together the perfect hockey player and you're looking for the best skating and the best feet and the best hands and the best shot and the and the best vision. You might not mention Tyler Bertuzzi's name in putting together that, but it's scrappy and competitive and dirty, and when he's feeling good about that, he's playing good. To be honest, the Leafs are not the team that I watch the most of.
And, of course.
In the hockey league. But I would like Tyler to feel a little bit better about himself and feel good about his game to see what he's adding. Because the few games that I watch, he hasn't scored, but he's a competitive, you know, scrappy, get it dirty, get it ugly, get in front of the net, get it, play in the corners, and just get the job done. That's when he's at his best. I think that would be something the Leafs would really want to have in their lineup.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because in the way that you're speaking about him, you got to wonder if maybe after breaking a slump like that, and because a lot of the stuff you're saying he's been providing this year, and it's why even in a market that's as critical as this one, he hasn't been criticized as much as a player who would get a big financial ticket, even though it is just a one-year deal. Like, there was a lot of promise, especially coming off of the playoffs that he had. But people do recognize, like, he is in those dirty areas, that he is a scrappy player, that he is a really underrated playmaker. It's just the puck has not gone in for him to the point where people have wondered, and myself included, like, if he's cursed, if there's a curse, because he's just, he's bouncing pucks off of, you know, wide open cages off the post. Like, and you could kind of see the frustration start to carry in his game. And now that he's been able to get one and he's kind of break this scoring streak, with what you're saying about the confidence of the player, that maybe this is going to start to unlock a little bit of just now you can kind of get back on a roll when, yeah, you've been in a slump for a very long time, finally see one goes in. It can just loosen things up for a guy like that a lot.
He hasn't had a ton of chance to be able to do it in his career up to this point, but I do feel he's a playoff type player. He wants the opportunity to be able to do it in the playoffs. When he gets it, I think he's going to have a chance to be an impact player at the important times for the Leafs.
Mm-hmm. Last one, and then I'll let you go. You've been super gracious with the time. Obviously, you're Sid's former coach, and Penguins at risk of missing the playoffs again. There's 1 year left on the deal, and Sidney Crosby is still one of the best players on the planet at age 36. Could you ever see him parting ways with the organization and try to pursue winning somewhere else?
The answer to that question is we saw Wayne Gretzky move from Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And so the answer is it can happen, but it's hard for anyone to think that it's possible.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
It can't happen, for sure. It happened to Wayne Gretzky, but I have a hard time picturing anything but a Penguins jersey on Sidney Crosby. Maybe Team Canada. That one goes on him pretty good too.
Yeah.
But
we like that
but,
one.
You like that one.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time picturing a different jersey on Sidney Crosby, and the Penguins, are in the fight right now to make the playoffs with probably 28 games left. Mm-hmm. But he's still playing at such a high level. He's still one of the best players in the game still, and I just in my heart feel that keeps going with the Penguins.
Oh, me too. I'd love to see him get another chance to win somewhere. It's weird always seeing those images. Like, nobody likes the pictures of other superstar players, like the greats, in the wrong sweater. But yeah, just it would be a real shame if the rest of Sidney Crosby's career ended up just being, you know, trying to scratch and claw your way to the playoffs and then not really having a true path there. Dan Bylsma, again, congrats on all the success this season, man. Thank you so much for making time for us today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Hey, take
care. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, of course. Dan Bylsma, head coach of the Coachella Valley Firebirds, AHL. Yeah, Stanley Cup champion, Jack Adams winner. Guy who's coached a lot of different players. It was fun to go over his resume and just kind of pick through the different things that we could talk about. Anyway, it's weird, the Sidney Crosby thing, because he's so damn good.
Yeah.
He's so damn good. And he's going into his final year and, seeing him get traded, how do you do that? What he means to Pittsburgh, what he means to hockey, what he just means to that sweater. And that's such a cool organization, too. Like, you see it with the Yager Knight. Lemieux didn't play for anybody else, but it's just Sid.
It would honestly be so weird to see any other.
I know, but it would feel so good to watch him go try to win a Stanley Cup, like in Colorado with Nathan MacKinnon.
Sure.
Right? Somehow. That one just feels always has felt natural to me.
Just because of the MacKinnon stuff.
I don't know. There's something about Colorado where it's just, all stars can go there. Like, we're all there. Ray Bourque went there. It's like, that's the spot. Whereas you can go there and win a Stanley Cup and it's sort of,
okay.
Switzerland.
We give it a pass somehow.
Yeah, exactly. You get a pass for going to Colorado. Stars go there. Anyway, let's take a quick break and hit the rest of what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so before we get to what we missed, just want to wrap up my thoughts on UFC 298. Almost coughed.
Good recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. So great that everybody noticed and looked at me weird. It's like, wow, what a recovery. That's what you want.
Stuck the landing. Yeah. Come on.
I mentioned that the Georgians broke out. Topuria was incredible. The boxing is so crisp. The Conor parallels are certainly there. He called out Conor McGregor, but he's not getting Conor McGregor, okay? Conor's not fighting Ilya Topuria, especially since he'll lose. Conor's fought, I think, 4 times in the last 5 years. He's 35 or 36 years old. The UFC is clearly trying to push him back to a card that they'll probably put some not-so-great fights on. They're certainly not putting any champions, because Ariel Helwani mentions champions UFC get pay-per-view points, and you're not putting Conor McGregor on with champs and giving them a taste. So Ilya Topuria is not getting that taste, although he would love it now that he's a champion. Oh my God, would he ever love it? Would he love a chance at Conor McGregor? Ain't going to happen. There was a little time afterwards where he basically said Volk's a nice guy, and so you want to give him the rematch, but he also said it's time to move on. It's weird with Volkanovski, because he's an older fighter who had this dominant reign, this incredible reign as champion. He's unbelievably well-liked. He's got the best walkout song in the business right now. He's known. He gave Max Holloway a rematch, who was a famous champion. He actually gave him two fights, because one of them was controversial. But yeah, I don't know how that fight goes differently. And now you've been knocked out in 2 straight fights. And we've seen this with older fighters. It's difficult. And yeah, you let him get knocked out once again. It's tough. I think you kind of have to give Volk the rematch, because there's nothing else really there for Topuria right now. But it doesn't feel as great of a rematch as it should. And now the Volkanovski decision to just fight Makhachev on short notice and getting knocked out by him looks like a disaster. Maybe the finances of it were all right. But from a legacy standpoint, we had Volk looking like the greatest pound-for-pound fighter on the planet. And then in less than a year, he's a guy who's been knocked out twice, and it looks like the career is over. So he's a huge loser in this, as much as Topuria is a winner. We'll always have Volkanovski as an all-time great. He has to be. But yeah, seeing a legend get folded twice by 2 also going to be awesome champions, because don't get it twisted, Topuria is going to be a champ for a while. He's really good. There was a hilarious moment of Sean Strickland celebrating the wins of Merab, and he's like, yeah, just what I wanted. I went, that's what you want, Merab and Topuria? Because I think that those 2 guys are going to be champions. Really good champions. Anyway, those two looked amazing. Rob just showing off to Mark Zuckerberg and bending Henry Cejudo's neck in front of Zuck, pointing at him, giving dapping him up after the fight. That was a real star-making moment. Rob is a star now. He is a star. He is a person that when he is going to be on a card, people are going to go, you got to watch this guy fight. Same with Topuria. And that's what the UFC wants, is they want fighters that I say to you, trust me, watch this guy. You're going to feel bang for your buck. You're going to be able to understand the way he fights, the pace that he fights with, either the pace, the boxing, the style, the energy, all that stuff. Both those guys were incredible. Like I mentioned, Volk is a loser. He just is. It sucks. It really sucks. I was rooting for Volk last minute because the pricing was Topuria plus 125. I jumped on that. I couldn't help myself. I was like, I have to bet against Volk. This is just a stupid line. And then, yeah, it turned out to be that way. The other loser is, to me, Ian Garry. I was blowing up Helwani's phone about it, and he was telling me to relax, but the crowd booed him, and they were right to boo him. I'm not relaxing on this. This guy had a huge opportunity. This was a star-making card. Two guys grabbed the opportunities, became stars. Another guy in Robert Whittaker, who's already a big name in the UFC, just showed what he always shows, which is that he is just a gamer. He is a warrior. He will battle. Took a ton of damage and still found a way to come back and beat Costa. Awesome performance from Bobby Whittaker. Big winner from the card. But these two guys had breakout performances, and here is this tall, lanky, cool, kickboxing Irishman who we know doesn't train in Ireland, doesn't fight in Ireland, doesn't have the cachet in Ireland as some of the other stars that have come from the region. But God, does the UFC know how to market an Irish star? And would they have loved to have had the next great Irish guy? And he goes out against Jeff Neal, and it's pretty much a weak points fight. A lot of him on the cage, a lot of him dapping up Jeff Neal weirdly, where it's like he wanted to be his best friend more than he wanted to beat his ass in the cage. And I hate that. I hate that attitude from a fighter. I'm all for respecting your opponent. I get that. But doing the multiple every time a guy breaks with you, doing the dap up, and his corner is yelling at him not to do it, and then going up against the cage and basically winning a crap split decision. Huge, huge, huge loser is Ian Garry. I don't want to watch an Ian Garry fight. Who cares? Joe Rogan was losing his mind because he loves kickboxing, and that's his thing. So he was hyping him up the entire time. Ooh, every kick. Yeah, he can kick. Cool. He has no personality. He got eviscerated by Sean Strickland. I'm sorry. It's like, yeah. He came out kind of before the media, and he was kind of a crybaby about it. He has been the entire time, and then he was, it's like, you're going to put that performance down after you're saying you're going to pick apart Sean Strickland? Like, I don't know, man. Anyway, doesn't look like a great one to me. Looks like an interesting fighter. Looks like he could beat a lot of guys on points. Looks like that range is a problem for fighters to deal with. But in terms of like a star that the UFC was hoping for, they went 2 for 3. They went 2 for 3 on that card, which is great. You'll take two for three every single time, but Ian Garry didn't see it. Did not see it. So 14-0 or whatever in mixed martial arts, but I'm guessing that number on the back end is going to change fairly quickly as he fights a little bit of stiffer competition. Anyways, what else we miss?
I want to talk a little more all-star stuff.
Oh, yeah, okay, cool.
I got some more thoughts. Yeah, so first off, three-point contest. You are out on the three-point contest?
I just think if Steph's not doing it, then who cares?
So it loses some juice.
Yeah, I think Steph has to do it. And I understand why he doesn't feel he needs to do it, but this is what I'm talking about with the stars of the game and the greats of the game, is if you don't care, then why would I care?
Sure.
And so not having Steph Curry in it when he's clearly the best and he put together the best round, it's like, just do it. And I would say this, next year, I would just throw Sabrina Ionescu and Caitlin Clark into the three-point contest. Don't make it a side spectacle. Yeah. Just say, hey, these two are actually in it because
they're shooting with the WNBA balls. They're shooting from
You got to re-rack it. You got to change it. Yeah,
sure.
Like, let them do it.
I agree.
Yeah,
definitely agree.
Because I actually think that does put more pressure on the field.
Sure.
You want to win.
Yeah. What is starry?
Huh?
You know, it used to be the Sprite ball. Now it's starry ball. Yes. Is that just like a pop that's in the States that's not here? I've never heard of
it. I don't know what it is, but I will say this. I really wish it didn't exist. The problem is like a lot of guys do shoot that three, and so having it be a part of it actually does make some sense.
It was funny to see Dame. Like, Dame was better from those, it seemed
For sure he was. And so I get it being a component, but to me, for the three-point contest, I would have wanted two things, which is get rid of that ball.
Yeah.
And two is actually you should penalize guys if they step on the line. Like, I'm sorry, but the Carl Anthony Towns thing,
no.
They went, they were joking about it during the broadcast going like, why are you snitching? And I went, yeah, kind of, but no.
It's not a long two contest.
Yeah, like he's clearly half a foot over the line on these. I get it if your toe scrapes one.
Sure.
But when you're setting up your entire jump shot from the corner, which is the threes that you should be knocking down the best, and you're just stepping on it over and over and over again, I went, all right, this kind of sucks that you're not calling that. So, no, I didn't like that. I just, three-point contest seems dead to me.
Really quickly before I pitch my Saturday night thing, LED court?
Hated it so much. Sucks. It's disgusting. And honestly, I know that they tried to make it so cool, but it was distracting, and I did not enjoy it. There was that. I didn't watch a lot of the Celebrity All-Star Game, I'll be honest. Like,
Of course not. I only did because I was at work. It was awful.
I threw it on for like a second when I was just flipping between that and PWHL. And they had one thing where they were like, whoever's heating up and gets the hot thing, like they were trying so hard to incorporate it. And I went, I can't even see the ball. I can't see what's going on because the court is so distracting. So cool that they put that in there, I guess.
Worth a shot, I guess. It was
a failure. Weird. And they kept trying to gas it up, and everyone, it was basically an edict. Like, you couldn't talk poorly about the court. And I went, yeah, but this court sucks.
Yeah.
This court clearly sucks. Why would I want this? This is the whole thing with the NBA right now, is they're trying to throw all these things at the wall. They're going like, what about LED? What about AI? What about the Google or the Apple headset on you and you can sit in a seat? And I'm like, how about just the players care and play games and a little bit of defense?
How about the players play games and the games matter more?
Yeah, how about that? How about they care about the standings and about the games? Because if you just do that, that'd be great. I'm telling you, man, I get my antennas are up for if there's one league that's just unstoppable, it's the NFL. NFL can do whatever it wants. People are going to watch. Like, the Taylor Swift story was hilarious because it's just like another league that can't lose, continues to find a way to win. I think baseball is on the come up in that it did some really great rule changes and it's dominating in local markets. It has the summer. It's a great sport to go to live. This city loves it. I think baseball is doing the right things. It's in the right direction, right trajectory right now, minus the free agency stuff. That's a little weird with, you know, four of the guys sitting out in free agency. The two leagues that I'm concerned about are NHL because they keep overexpanding and they're losing a lot of physical play in the game. And I think that sucks. I think you need to have the NHL feel like a physical league with hitting and passion and caring and some nasty figures. And to me, that's being bred out of the game to a degree where I'm going, I don't want to watch the NHL if it's going to look more like the All-Star game. I don't want to see purely skill. The NHL is supposed to be the sport where when other people show up, they go, man, this is nasty. These guys hit hard. It's a dangerous sport. You need to have that danger element. If you don't, you're losing something. But NBA, I'm telling you, is for a sport that was just winning, winning, winning. And we thought they had all the off-court drama. And with the NHL, we would say, oh, you know, they got to learn from the NBA, the way it markets itself. It's become a adult soap opera in the way that I feel like wrestling is. Like, I don't want to watch wrestling, but if I see a video online where it's a podcast of guys talking about why CM Punk is a bad guy, I'll watch that, even though I never watch CM Punk. Yeah. I feel like the NBA has the same appeal right now where you want to hear about the storylines and everybody cares about LeBron, maybe go to the Warriors and the things that he says coming out of All-Star Weekend, but does anybody really want to watch LeBron play the Sacramento Kings at 10 o'clock at night?
Like, Tuesday, I don't know. Okay, so let me quickly pitch this All-Star thing. So what if we kind of did away with, like, just the dunk contest and whatever and almost kind of used some of the NHL skills thing and almost did, like, a decathlon-style thing? You get, like, 10 guys who, like, all do the three-point contest. They all do the dunk contest. You get two dunks, high score, whatever carries on. There's, like, I guess you could do a one-on-one thing. Do the skills thing.
The NBA is supposed to be a sport where everybody is different. It used to be the league where it was like there's Shaq and there's
not anymore.
But I don't want to see Giannis in a contest where it's like he's going to have to shoot threes against Steph and then he has got to go play one-on-one. Like, it doesn't work that way. You got to have it be positional.
Maybe.
And then the guys don't care about the actual game. So why would they invest in this?
The biggest problem for sure is, and like that's even Ant said, I just read a quote of Ant saying like, yeah, this will always just be an All-Star game to me. It's never going to be a thing. I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, so this is it. To me, I'm trying to think about solutions, but it does feel like too far gone. The only hope that I think the NBA All-Star game has is if whoever becomes the next face of the league decided, like, someone on the come-up, let's say Wemby. Wemby shows up and he actually has cachet. I don't think he will because he's an international guy. I do think it has to be an American-born player. I'm just telling you, that's what I feel. I think like to have the across the board appeal, it's going to have to be a great American player who just says, yo, I'm digging in on this.
I'm setting the tone.
I'm playing defense the entire game, and I'm going to try and other guys fall in line.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got to go. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast. We'll be back tomorrow.